What do the following people have in common?
I am a carer. I am a radio presenter. I am a singer.
I am a musician. I am a producer. I am a songwriter.
I'm a receptionist. I'm a mother. I'm a part-time student.
Did you guess correctly? They're all people with type 1 diabetes, but you probably wouldn't know that from looking at them, or working or even socialising with them. Type 1 diabetes accounts for approximately 12% of all people living with diabetes. There's still no exact reason yet as to why people get this, and no cure either. This is Diabetes, the Forgotten Type 1s, the documentary looking at diabetes as a whole, but also focusing at points in type 1 diabetes, where she'll talk to the specialists, the doctors, the organisations, the researchers, and most importantly, the people living with type 1 diabetes. I began my investigations into diabetes by talking to Professor Seamus Screenan, consultant of diabetes and endocrinology at Connolly Hospital in Blanchardstown. I spoke to him first about his 6 years of training in the University of Chicago.
That's correct. Yeah, I did 6 years of training in the University of Chicago back in the late 90s. And that was a combination of both clinical training with patients, and also research. And the research interests of the department where I worked was in beta cell dysfunction. Big word, but it basically means is that one of two problems in type 2 diabetes is that the pancreas doesn't make enough insulin. And we were exploring the reasons why the pancreas doesn't make enough insulin in people who either are likely to develop diabetes or already have diabetes. So it was a very interesting time. We got to answer a lot of important questions. Yeah. And we did that by taking a genetic approach and finding abnormal genes that were linked to diabetes, and then trying to understand how those abnormal genes interfered with the normal functioning of the pancreas.
There seems to be a lot more awareness now of diabetes on the whole as a condition, including both types 1 and type 2. Is this because there's a higher prevalence now of people with the conditions, or is this because there is more education and information out there for people in the media?
Well, I think it's a combination of both, and clearly the prevalence of diabetes is increasing. That is partly due to the fact that our unhealthy lifestyles are taking a toll. We've had, I think, unhealthy lifestyles dating back now over a couple of decades for sure, and as a result of that, as a race, we're gaining more weight, and that's unfortunately impacting and translating into increased rates of weight-related conditions such as diabetes. But there's also an increased awareness. There's a lot more screening going on, so GPs are testing patients more regularly, patients who they think might be at risk of developing diabetes, and therefore I think some of the increased prevalence that we see is because nurses, dietitians, GPs, even in some cases pharmacists, may be screening for diabetes in the general population and picking it up sooner.
And could you tell us in a basic way what the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes is?
Okay, well, we can take two approaches to that. One approach will be to think of how the disease originates in the first instance. Type 1 diabetes occurs because the pancreas is damaged, and the part of the pancreas that makes insulin is essentially destroyed. So people with type 1 diabetes cannot make any insulin any longer. The implication of that is that they have to have insulin. Eventually they'll die if they don't take insulin treatment. In type 2 diabetes, it's a bit different. And the problem there is, as we understand it currently, is that the body becomes resistant to insulin. And in the early stages of diabetes, while this type 2 diabetes is developing, the pancreas can compensate. It can make more insulin. And by making more insulin, that keeps the blood sugar normal. It overcomes, if you like, the insulin resistance. But eventually, at some stage down the line, the pancreas fails. And although it's still making insulin, unlike type 1 diabetes, it's not able to make enough to overcome that insulin resistance, and therefore the blood sugar starts to rise.
And type 1 diabetes, now I know some also refer to that sometimes as childhood diabetes or onset childhood diabetes, because it's something a lot of people with that particular strain of the condition get before the age of 10, or indeed in their teens or early teens. And obviously, I suppose at that age, there can't have been much that they've done wrong in terms of lifestyle, maybe if they get it at 6 or 7 or even younger. Have they come any closer yet to discovering why people get type 1 diabetes?
The prevalence of both type 1 and type 2 diabetes is increasing. Now, I've alluded to some of the reasons for type 2, probably our unhealthy lifestyles. I don't think we have a good handle at this stage why type 1 prevalence is also increasing. The current thinking would be that there's a genetic component, in other words, that we inherit a risk for developing type 1 diabetes, and it's probably about a 5% chance if you've got somebody in your immediate family who has type 1 diabetes, you've got a 5% chance of developing diabetes, which is obviously much higher than if you don't have anybody in the family who's got type 1 diabetes. But on top of that genetic trait, there's also some environmental factors. They may be multiple and they may be varied. We currently think that viral infections probably have a role to play, but there's lots of other theories, such as allergies to food constituents, and even some people have speculated vaccinations may be involved. So I think the fact that there are a lot of proposed reasons for those environmental factors means we don't have a good handle on exactly what the most important environmental factors are that trigger diabetes in those who have a genetically inherited risk.
Now, I've read that there's an expected 62% increase in diabetes by the year 2020. Do you think, as there is more knowledge coming into the public arena and more public awareness now, that these figures are accurate? Or do you think that that might indeed, that knowledge, I suppose, and education might indeed reduce that figure somewhat?
Well, that depends on a number of factors. One is obviously the wider public awareness, and I think there has been a lot of focus in the media in the last 10 years on diabetes. So I would hope that that would translate into a greater awareness and that people will take the important messages on board, because we tend to focus, I think, a lot on the negative when we're talking about diabetes, and obviously it's increasing in prevalence. That's a bad thing. But we also have evidence from research studies in the last 10, 15 years that type 2 diabetes in particular can be prevented, so that if you do adopt a healthy lifestyle, exercise more regularly and eat healthier, you can certainly at least delay the onset of type 2 diabetes, if not prevent it in the longer term. So I think that we probably are negative and basing our projections on the speed at which in the last 10 to 15 years we've seen type 2 diabetes accelerate. But at the same time, I don't want to minimize the risk, and there's definitely going to be an ongoing, continuing increasing in prevalence over the next 10 to 15 years.
And in making this programme, we spoke to people in both Ireland and Scotland, and in the Scottish Research Network, I know that they told me that in Scotland anyway, the statistics were pretty much on par with the rest of the world, perhaps excluding America, as there's been quite stark increases over there. Would Ireland be on par with the way the condition has grown globally, or would you find Ireland to be slightly above, perhaps, or below the global average?
Well, one of the things in Ireland is that we don't actually have very good prevalence figures, unlike other countries. In Scotland, have very good databases and a very good handle on the prevalence of the diabetes and how they manage the diabetes and so on. We don't have that good information, so the prevalence figures that you hear for Ireland are generally estimated based on the prevalence in similar countries. I'd say our general perception as people looking after people with diabetes is that the rates would be very similar to any other Western population, maybe not quite as advanced as the United States, North Americans, but certainly any other similar European population.
And as someone who's worked within the field of diabetes for a number of years, how do you feel the condition is reported on in the media?
It's very, as I said, you very often hear very negative perceptions of diabetes. Very often the images presented in the media are the totally negative ones. I think it's very important to accentuate the important message that research in the last 10 to 15 years, both in type 1 and in type 2, has shown that if you control the condition very well, that the complication rates can be significantly delayed or prevented. And that's a very important message to get across to people with diabetes.
So next on my travels to discover a bit more about diabetes, I thought I should talk to somebody with the condition. I caught up with Greg French, who's a musician and producer. And I started off by asking Greg when he was first diagnosed with the condition.
I believe, as far as I remember, I was about 12 or 13 when I was diagnosed. But funnily enough, I think I was in a position where I was able to test my blood when I was about 11. And I think when my poor mum saw that it was high, she tried to pray it away for a year or two, you know, just thought it was a mistake, you know. My older brother was a diabetic as well. That's why she kind of tested me one day because I was feeling like crap.
All right, so that would be my next question to you. So it is prevalent in your family already?
It is indeed. My granddad actually was one of the first diabetics, insulin or treated diabetics in Ireland. So I'd always known about it and seen all his very antique, almost antique blood testing equipment and needles, the biggest friggin' needles you could imagine. And he was very quiet about it. We always just knew and saw the equipment around. And then my older brother, he's just 1 year older than me, was diagnosed when he was 10. So, I mean, it was never something unusual to me. And when it happened, it was actually quite easy on me. You know, I think compared to a lot of other people, because it was in my family, it was just, we just get on with it. You know, I just went into hospital for the week. You know, mom knew everything already. They did some tests and then just put me on the insulin. And I just took to it no problem at all because I'd seen my brother do it for so long. And my granddad, which, you know, I believe the theory is that it does skip a generation, whatever the diabetes law is, you know.
And I suppose almost for you then, it was like you were fitting in with the family rather than, oh no, this terrible thing that's been thrown upon me.
Yeah, I do remember when I was a kid seeing Ian do that, and he'd be obviously, you know, a kind of, you know, an idol to me, you know, a year older to me, he's the cool brother. So I remember actually nicking his needles at one point and, you know, trying to inject myself. And I was just thinking back to that, and it's like, yeah, I used to do that, you know, and then a year after I discover I'm a diabetic.
So you got what you wished for, yeah.
Yeah, I was delighted, in fact, I think, at the time, because I was thinking to myself, yes, I remember my brother getting loads of toys when he was in hospital, so I kind of felt good at the time.
And did you find that, obviously, like you say, the family maybe made changes when your brother developed condition? Did you, personally, though, did you have to make changes to your own life then?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. But at that age, you know, you have so much energy, you don't feel... and even before, I never felt that I'd feel weak, but you'd blow stuff off quicker. You'd kind of throw it off, you know, if you're feeling ill or you're feeling unwell for 5 minutes. But 10 minutes later, when you start feeling better, you feel a whole lot better. It's not going from, I feel a little bit better. You're suddenly, you've got the energy to do all that. It didn't feel like I was making too many changes because we'd all sort of been eaten properly, since Ian was doing it anyway, my older brother, we would keep a regimen, I suppose somewhat of a routine to our eating, because, you know, you're going to the same school or we're doing the same things, and Ian would need to stop for lunch or dinner. That was the case, and we all would stop for dinner around the same time, so it didn't feel like it was too different. And counting, I kind of semi understood the counting of the carbohydrates and stuff like that, so I think it was pretty easy on me. I was very lucky.
And Greg, as people's knowledge of type 2 diabetes nowadays is probably much greater than that of type 1, does it frustrate you a bit when you meet somebody and it comes into conversation and without you pointing out that you have type 1, perhaps presume that you have type 2 diabetes?
I've often gotten into heated debates with people because I'm pretty passionate about it. And I've gotten into heated debates with people who, you know, the only thing they know is type 2 diabetes. And I remember actually one or two people kind of were saying, oh, well, you know, type 2 diabetes is a lot tougher and it's a lot worse. Type 1 diabetes, and I mean, if you can put a kind of level of badness on the disease itself. Ours, and that is the fundamental difference, I suppose. Ours is an autoimmune, I think, anyway. This is what I believe. And the other is, I suppose, somewhat through lifestyle or some conditions can cause type 2. So I would get into heated debates with people when they'd say something like that, because, you know, it is annoying, you know, the fundamental thing, it is annoying being a diabetic, especially being a type 1 diabetic. Mm. And the other things are, there's lots of complications and things that, you know, we hear about all the complications about people who do, unfortunately, lose their legs and lose their sight, and which is all, as technology moves on, becomes less, it happens less. But there's lots of other things that aren't really discussed about diabetes, which are, you know, equally as bad for me and for a lot of other people.
I was talking to somebody telling me a story of a man who had sort of collapsed with a low blood sugar, and people just walked past him in the street because they thought he was drunk because it was of an evening, you know.
Oh yeah, well, I was rushed into hospital and from a venue where, you know, there was a venue where there was alcohol, and there was, you know, it was a pretty rock and roll venue, and my blood did go low, and I was rushed out into the hospital, and I was literally, it was so hard because I was totally unconscious, but it was so hard for the people who were with me to convince the doctors and the nurses around that I was a diabetic and this wasn't an alcohol-induced thing. And it was kind of, you know, I wasn't awake for a lot of it, but it really upset the people that were around me, that the reaction that they got, that they assumed and wouldn't take it any other way, that I was completely and utterly drunk, you know. And because at the time they didn't have the blood sugars, I didn't have the blood testing kit on me, and actually I just had insulin, you know. You think that would have been enough for them, but they just assumed that no, it was absolutely, and it was very difficult. But so I have been in that experience before, and it's not at all nice. People do assume you're drunk, or they do assume, there's lots of other things as well, like, as you know, before you may faint or going to a complete hypo, you do get very confused, and you do get, there's lots of these other things that do come out as well, and don't know what's happening to you. And even though you can logically say, if you can calmly say to yourself, this is my blood sugar going low, but sometimes you don't realize, or you're in the heat of the moment, or you're doing something, it can be very confusing and disorientating. And also it leads to lots of other things, because, I mean, when you're confused and in that state, you get panicky as well, which can be a lot worse, and it just, you know, it's strange the reactions that it does induce, I suppose.
Yeah. Having found out a bit about diabetes itself and talking to somebody with the condition, I wondered if there were any services available out there. I discovered Diabetes Ireland, who provides support and patient information to people in Ireland with diabetes and their families. I spoke to Anne Mullen, Development Officer with the organisation, and asked her firstly if she could tell us a bit more about the services they offer.
Certainly, Heather. Diabetes Ireland is the sort of national diabetes charity. It started back in 1967, and it's sort of grown and gone from strength to strength since that. Our main aim really would be to provide support and information and sort of motivation for people with diabetes and for their families and for their friends.
And what would your own role be there as development officer?
Well, we have about 5 development officers throughout the country, and part of our role would be education, and that we run courses for people with type 2 diabetes. And we also would be involved in setting up things like parent and family support groups, running public education meetings for people with type 1 and type 2 diabetes. We would be perhaps organising public screenings, raising awareness. There's it's a huge aspect of our work, because I presume, as you know yourself, Heather, there's a lot of sort of undiagnosed diabetes in the country. Type 1 diabetes is the kind of diabetes that generally sort of younger people get, and it tends to come on very quickly. The symptoms appear very quickly, such as things like tiredness, extreme thirst, weight loss, running to the toilet a lot, those kind of symptoms. And often, particularly with children, people will describe that they see them melting away because they're losing weight so fast. So the onset of type 1 diabetes can actually be very dramatic. Type 2 diabetes, on the other hand, tends to come on generally when people are a bit older, maybe over 40, even though you can get it younger, but it tends to come on over a long period of time. And, you know, the symptoms like tiredness, thirst, no energy, those kind of symptoms can be, so many people can have those symptoms, and often they aren't noticed until maybe people might have had diabetes for a number of years before they discover they have it.
Now, I know there's around 190,000 people currently living with diabetes. That includes both type 1 and 2, and this is expected to rise to around 230,000 in the next number of years. Would you be right in thinking this is going to impact on the health service and, of course, your own services?
You're right, it's huge. At the moment, they reckon about one person in 20 has diabetes, which is, which is enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, Heather, is that while they reckon that there's about 30,000 people in Ireland at the moment with undetected diabetes, they actually reckon there's nearly 150,000 people with undetected pre-diabetes.
Okay.
And pre-diabetes is sort of the stage before you actually develop diabetes. And I think in the next few years, we'll see those people being really targeted.
And do they have tests that would pick that up, if you know what
that's
I mean?
Right, yes. Just a very simple blood test can identify if you are if you have pre-diabetes, and that's the point at which people can perhaps make lifestyle change. Now, that would be pre-type 2 diabetes we're talking here, once again.
Yeah.
But, at that point in time, people can actually start making changes to their lifestyle and perhaps prevent the onset of diabetes in the ideal situation, or certainly delay it for hopefully a lot of time.
And now, I know that Diabetes Ireland involved with a website called myinsulin.ie. I'm aware it's more targeted towards people with type 2 diabetes, but can you tell me briefly about that?
Certainly. It's my insulin is a website for, well, it's got a lot of general information about diabetes on it, but one of its targets would be people on insulin, and particularly maybe people who have type 2 diabetes who need to go on insulin. A lot of people with type 2 diabetes will be treated with tablets, diet alone or diet and tablets. But more and more people are needing to go on insulin now because they've had diabetes for a longer period of time, And there can be a great reluctance and a great sort of resistance to that, and a sort of sense, well, I've failed, you know, I have to go on injections now because I've not looked after myself right, or I've failed. But in fact, it can just be inevitable for some people that they'll need to go on insulin. And this site aims to sort of, I think, take a bit of the fear out of that and provide information and debunk some of the myths, you know, that it's my fault I have to go on insulin, or, you know, that kind of thing, to sort of help people.
And does somebody with type 2 diabetes who goes on to insulin, would they then become a person with type 1 diabetes, or would you still refer to them as a person with type 2 diabetes?
Somebody with type 2 diabetes would always have type 2 diabetes.
All right, okay.
Yeah, I know.
So is there a difference then between a person with type 2 diabetes on insulin to a person with type 1? Is it that physically they got the condition a different way, or is it that it's still different although they're on insulin, if that makes sense?
Yeah, and in fact it's a great question, because people often ask that. You know, it's quite different in that people, when they have type 1 diabetes, they don't produce any insulin at all whatsoever. And they're completely dependent on their insulin injections every day, and would get quite sick quite fast without their insulin. Someone with type 2 diabetes, even when they need injections, they'll still have a certain amount of insulin in their system. They may be already, they might be on 2 or 3 tablets. So the insulin they're getting is to help their control and to sort of provide a bit more insulin, but they'll still have a certain amount of their own insulin that'll be working.
Okay.
So it's still type 2, and they would still have like the risks, the cardiac risks and that associated with type 2. They would still have all of that.
And Anne, although I know type 1 diabetes is the minority within the condition as a whole, do you think there's enough awareness and knowledge out there, I suppose, for the people with the condition and perhaps for people living with or working with people with the condition?
The two problems, I suppose, are the two things that hold it back are that you can't prevent, even having all the information, you cannot prevent someone getting type 1. And as you say, the smaller numbers, there's about 14,000 people in total in Ireland with type 1 diabetes, compared with, you know, 191,000 with type 2.
Absolutely.
So it's sort of the weight of numbers. But I do think, you know, because type 1 can be, you know, it is a very serious condition, I think there should be more information, and people should be made more aware, you know, not just in terms of themselves, but their friends. Do their friends have type 1? You know, just a wider awareness, and I think that is better for people with type 1, because they will be kept safer in that environment. You know, if people were more aware of type 1 diabetes and sort of what it involves, I think life would be a lot easier for people with type 1 diabetes.
Now, Anne, while Diabetes Ireland sounds a bit like a business or an organisation, it's also a charity. I know you do some charity work, and the monies from that can go towards research for the condition. Can you tell me a bit about that side of the organisation?
Certainly, yes. Yes, as I said, Diabetes Ireland is a charity, and we are constantly fundraising, really. We provide a lot of services. As I say, we have a telephone helpline, and we have a national one and we have local ones. We will produce a lot of information leaflets, and we have a quarterly magazine. And then we also run things like, we run activity days for children. We have a kids club. We would have a lot of activities like that. And then as well as that, we have, in the last couple of years, we've linked with a group called the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. And they do a huge amount of research into the causes of diabetes, particularly type 1. And so Diabetes Ireland now fundraises. We fundraise, and we have the Diabetes Ireland Research Alliance, which is all of the money in that goes to diabetes research. The website is www.diabetes.ie.
So now I had a bit of information about diabetes, in particular type 1 diabetes. I wondered if there was much research going on out there for the conditions as a whole, also for type 1 diabetes, as there still seemed to be a bit of a quandary about why people got the condition, and indeed if it ever seemed to be likely there would be a cure for the condition. So I hopped across the waters to Scotland and spoke to Shona Brearley, the manager of the Scottish Diabetic Research Network. This was set up in 2006, and I started off by asking Shona to tell us a bit about the organisation and why they'd set this up.
Started in 2006 as part of the UK's clinical research collaboration, started by Gordon Brown when he was Chancellor, to try and stimulate and improve on clinical research in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that we improve the quality and the quantity of diabetes research in Scotland. We are funded by the Scottish Government, by the Department of Health, to improve diabetes research across the whole of Scotland, not just sort of bigger cities, but to take in the rural areas as well.
And would you say that there was a sort of a need or what have you to set this up because diabetes on the whole, both I suppose type 1 and particularly type 2, have increased in the last number of years and unfortunately look set to increase again?
Yes, I mean, because there's been such a massive rise in the numbers of both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, it's really important to investigate what's causing it. Is it environmental factors, or can we look at different treatments, what complications people have, so that we can both develop new treatments for the future and to look at service planning for these individuals, because we also need to look at what kind of impact they will have on the health service. And if we can develop better treatments and get them, help the pharma companies get better treatments to the market quicker, then that benefits patients in the long run.
Now, in terms of type 1, you were telling me about the Scottish Diabetic Research Network type 1 diabetes resource. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Kind of
about
this study is a very large study funded by the Chief Scientist Office, which is the Department of Health in Scotland, and by Diabetes UK, the charity. And it's aiming to recruit 10,000 patients with type 1 across all the health boards in Scotland, and it will take what's called a DNA profile from all of those patients. It will be anonymised sample, so there's no names attached, but we can then match certain DNA profiles with people who develop certain complications so that we can see that in the future we would be able to do somebody's phenotype and look at their DNA profile and hopefully be able to predict what kind of complications they may develop and be able to treat them before the complications develop. So it will enhance the care of patients.
Now, Shona, I know that Scotland is a country people would jibe and jest a little bit about people's diets and lifestyles. And in Ireland, it's about 12% of people have type 1 diabetes, and there's around 190,000 people in total with diabetes as a whole. Would you say that the statistics in Scotland are the same, or do you find them to be slightly above or below the global average?
In Scotland, there's over 250,000 people with diabetes now, and about that, about 15% have type 1. So we have quite a lot of type 1s, and that's kind of fairly consistent around the world. Some of the Indian subcontinent countries and sub-Saharan Africa, which can have quite a large incidence of diabetes. Some of the Middle Eastern countries now, as they develop their Western lifestyles, their incidence of diabetes is increasing quite remarkably.
And do you think, so you would say Scotland anyway are kind of on par with the rest of the world?
We're probably on par with the rest of the world. We're a couple of years behind the States with the States' explosion in diabetes, but we're getting there. It is still increasing at an alarming rate.
But I suppose with things like your network there, be looking to sort of reduce the increase in diabetes. That's what some of these studies are for.
Some of these studies are looking to reduce the increase. We do a few studies looking at prevention and trying to stop diabetes before it happens. And we've got one study at the moment which is running in Edinburgh, which is looking at giving dietary advice to families, but it is mainly type 2s, but to Asian families with type 2 in the family. Mm. They're giving dietary advice to them to try and help their calorie intake and help stop the development of diabetes.
And you were telling me a bit about the removal study, I think. Was it Professor Petrie you were saying was doing that?
Professor John Petrie in Glasgow is leading on this worldwide study, which looks at the addition of metformin, which is a drug normally used in type 2 diabetes, by giving it to patients with type 1. Now, we know that metformin has some sort of cardioprotective effects. It stops getting problems with the arteries around your heart. And what we think is that it probably has the same effect in type 1 as type 2, but we need to have evidence before we can prescribe it. So this study is looking at giving people with type 1 diabetes a dose of metformin and then looking at what's called cardiovascular biomarkers and surrogate markers. So we measure the thickness of a vein in their neck or an artery in their neck, and that gives them an indication of how if there's any thickening in the arteries around their heart. And we'll follow these patients up for a few years, see if we think anything's getting worse or if we feel the metformin is helping these arteries not to become furred up. The study has been led from Glasgow but is operating in Canada, Australia, Denmark, Holland and in England as well.
Now, Shona, once or twice a year, I know going back in my head, I would read articles in the newspapers about cures for type 1 diabetes, but they never seem to come to fruition. Are we any closer to finding a cure or indeed possibly prevention for people from getting type 1 diabetes?
I think they are getting there, but I think sometimes the media gives people a little bit more false hope. Stem cell transplants were thought to be the big breakthrough, and we have been carrying out stem cell transplants in Scotland. But the problem is to do one stem cell transplant for a patient, you need two pancreas. So you need two donor people. for one patient, and issues of compatibility and things make things very difficult. And obviously, you know, it's very intensive to do a stem cell transplant, and it's not the easiest procedure to be carried out. So not going to happen for the thousands and thousands of people probably in my lifetime, for the people who would need it. But hopefully eventually it will become much, much simpler.
Now, Shona, we've been talking here quite a lot about type 1 diabetes, and there are type 1 and type 2, and there would be a lot of information out there in terms of education and in the media for people with type 2 diabetes. Do you think that in Scotland anyway, is there a good bit of coverage by the media, and do you think there's enough knowledge out there for people with type 1 diabetes as well?
I think people are becoming increasingly aware of the two different types. I think on the whole, diabetes research in Scotland gets very good press. The press is quite keen to promote the studies we're doing, and they've helped us raise awareness, which makes the public much keener to come to us. So, for example, when we announced the type 1 bioresource, you know, patients heard about the type 1 bioresource in the media and contacted their local diabetes centre so they could participate. So that's really helpful for us, you know, if the media raises awareness of studies that we're going on. We'll be looking to recruit massive numbers of patients so that we can make sort of significant findings about the DNA of people with type 1 diabetes. We just have to urge a word of caution that, you know, not everything you read on the internet is true, and people have to, if they research their condition on the internet, to go to reputable websites and not some of the less reputable ones.
Sure, and I suppose always check with your doctor
or your clinical team. Yeah.
Now, for people living with chronic illnesses like diabetes, there are a lot of people involved in the care and support, I suppose, of the condition. And this doesn't just extend to family and doctors and consultants. It also involves nurses and dietitians and such like. So I decided to talk to clinical nurse specialist in diabetes, Margaret Corbett, from Connolly Hospital in Dublin, about the condition and their role within the patient's lives. And I started off by asking Margaret what exactly nurse specialists, or some may refer to them clinical nurse specialists in diabetes, are.
Diabetes nurse specialists, or clinical nurse specialists in diabetes, I suppose different terminology in different countries. I suppose we're all a group of registered nurses with many years, varied numbers of years, working with patients with diabetes. And I suppose from an educational point of view, all diabetes nurse specialists or clinical nurse specialists in diabetes, they now hold multiple qualifications. That would be a nursing degree, and following on from that, a graduate diploma in diabetes studies. We would be academically well qualified, as well as having many, many years of clinical experience.
And you were telling me also something in the last 5 or 6 years that you've then had to go on, I think, to train a little bit in, is being a nurse prescriber.
Yes, actually, that's something new. In the past probably decade, many countries have undertaken nurse prescribing now. It works very, very well for nurses, I suppose, that are working with people with chronic illness and A&E departments. There are certain areas, I suppose, that are more suitable to nurse prescribers. It can, in my area, it can certainly free up patients having to follow up appointments for reviews by medical team when they need further medication, because type 2, as we know, is a progressive condition. And as their condition deteriorates, they need added on medication. There's often 3 and 4 lines of medication that they need, and then maybe insulin at the end.
And Margaret, what would you consider the role was of the diabetic nurse specialists within the department?
I suppose the role is primarily that of education of the person with both type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And I suppose if we look at the entire diabetes population globally, about 85% have got type 2 diabetes, and the remaining 15 to 20% or 80 to 85 with type 2 would have type 1, about 15 to 20%. So we actually educate both type 1 and type 2 patients. And I suppose education and support is a lifelong process due to the chronic nature of the condition.
Also, I know something that is encouraged with both patients of type 1 and type 2 diabetes between appointments, if they've any queries or they come across any problems, to call up the nurses as well. Would you have particular common problems people come to you with?
Yeah, this is a huge part of our workload. We can receive anything from 20 plus calls in the day for advice on diabetes. They're all diabetes-related issues. And I suppose sometimes in a busy diabetes centre, resources required to deal with such calls, they're rarely really formally identified. So you can often be struggling with your day's work as well as trying to dedicate 2 hours to telephone communication. But it has great advantages. It can actually prevent patients from being admitted to hospital, improve their control without having to make a visit to the clinic. So on a daily basis, we kind of dedicate about 2 hours in the morning and two in the afternoon to telephone communication. And people call in with things like maybe their glucose levels. They've seen a change in the pattern over the last week or so. Maybe their levels are running high. On the other hand, they might be running low. So we just look at their lifestyle, see if for those people who are maybe showing that they're having low blood sugars over the past few days, have they lost weight or have they been exercising a little bit more? Maybe we need to reduce their insulin. And very often, indeed, we've dealt with acute issues on the phone where we have kind of helped a family member to recover the person without having to actually attend the A&E department. Telephone communication also, I might as well mention there, Heather, that we look after public health nurses, practice nurses, and indeed GPs have many queries at times as well. So it's a very, very large part of our daily workload.
So I believe that as well as the clinics you run in Connolly Hospital, you also do ward visits as well. Can you explain to me a bit about what they are and what they involve, I suppose?
We visit all of our diabetes patients on the wards, maybe those that are newly diagnosed or if they're already patients of our diabetes centre in Connolly Hospital. We will review them in the wards while they're inpatients, and newly diagnosed obviously will be educated at ward level and then follow up in the diabetes centre. Also, we see patients frequently in the accident and emergency department following their sugars have been stabilised, maybe there, and they might be newly diagnosed and they might very often be started on insulin there and not admitted at all. So that's kind of a very good service again and prevents admission to hospital, you know, which can be often very alarming for a newly diagnosed person. Sometimes it's easier to deal with it as an outpatient thereafter.
So although education and knowledge of diabetes on the whole is far greater these days, it's by no means a new phenomenon in terms of a medical condition. I thought it'd be interesting to talk to somebody who'd had the condition much longer, and so I spoke to Anne McDonald about the changes in care and knowledge, who's had the condition of type 1 diabetes for 34 years. And I began by asking her when she found out she first had diabetes.
Well, initially I was diagnosed when I was having my last child, but because my first child was over 10 pounds, that was a sort of a clue that I might have had it before then, but it hadn't been totally detected. So it was from my last child that it was detected, and I was brought in to the hospital for treatment and to have the whole thing explained.
And that's something I've actually heard in the past as well while making this programme, Anne, that people with type 1 diabetes can have bigger babies. Is there a reason for this?
It's just the condition and the way the blood sugars work. Things aren't exactly working the way they should, so the baby grows bigger inside. Yeah. And that's the danger for ladies who are pregnant. And then sometimes it works out that even when they're pregnant, at the end, they are put on insulin, even till they have the baby, just for safety's sake.
And would you, over that period, say of 34 years, would you think people's perceptions of the condition have changed?
Well, definitely in the early days, I did find most people didn't understand the whole, that there were two types of diabetes and that they're certainly different, the symptoms. And it's much more complicated and in type 1. And there is really no vacation from it in that you can't just forget it. You have to test your blood a couple of times a day. You have to eat properly. You have to know about the amount of carbs and what you're eating to this, so you take the right amount of insulin. And the main reason for that is they don't want you to suffer highs or lows. If you're low, you'll probably feel it quicker and you can look after it yourself. That's why you're supposed to carry some sugary thing on you. The best quick fix for a low is Lucozade or Jelly Babies. And then if it's very high, your blood sugar, you probably might be aware that you're not feeling right. But if it gets extremely high, you could just go into a coma. And then somebody has to call the ambulance for you because they have to inject you so that they can bring the blood sugar down. But so it's very important on both ends, those complications. And the nearest people nearest to you should understand the whole thing, really. Yeah. And I mean, since my time, the invention of the pen, the much finer needles, the blood sugar testing machines are excellent.
And you're talking about advances there. I know something you did recently was the DAPHNE projects, which stands for...
Well, DAPHNE stands for Dose Adjustment for Normal Eating. It's a course that you take for diabetic care. And it's a whole week, 5 day, 8 hours a day course that I went to the one in Vincent's Hospital. And I think it is being given at other hospitals as well. And it's really so worthwhile for anyone with type 1 diabetes, because it's just like going to the University of Diabetes. You get the full knowledge of everything. And then you're able to cope because you just understand it better. And it's very important to be in the right range of your blood sugar all throughout the day, and especially going to bed, because you don't want to, just from lack of taking your blood, have a low, which you wake up in the middle of the night and the symptoms are sweating. And if you have to have something right near your bed, like a bottle of Lucozade, and you just take one third of it. You don't really have to drink the whole bottle. You have to immediately cure your low blood sugar, or, you know, you will pass out and then they'll have to call an ambulance anyway. So you have to have all this knowledge on it, you know, and you feel much more confident after the course. And it explains all about carbohydrates and how much is in all the other foods that we normally eat, like bread, potatoes, pasta. And it's just a very, very, very helpful course that they're giving.
So while diabetes is largely known as a condition which includes carbohydrate counting and trying to live a healthy lifestyle and, you know, monitoring blood sugars and taking injections and all these many factors already, unfortunately also can affect other things such as your eyesight, kidneys, and your circulation just generally isn't as good overall, which, you know, I've been told they also check, for example, circulation, particularly in the lower limbs area. Some people unfortunately do have to have amputations if this becomes a problem around the lower limb area. It's already quite a difficult condition to live with on a day-to-day basis, and these are also things that you have to monitor.
That's right. So they are the three major side effects of type 1 diabetes, and that's why you have to go to your doctor, your clinic, a couple of times a year, twice at least, to be able to monitor all this. And stress, I'm afraid to say, affects all of this badly. Mm-hmm. If a diabetic is under a lot of stress, it will affect their whole condition and maybe bring on the abnormal blood vessels and the kidney strain and the, you know, even, you know, feet problems. Mm. So you have to try to remain as unstressed as you possibly can and live a healthy lifestyle. Yes, unfortunately, yes, I did have some eye problems. And that's why it's so important to be under an ophthalmologist and to be checked regularly for these abnormal blood vessels at the back of your eye. Because when they bleed, your eyesight, you know, is gone for the time that they've bled. And they have to do laser treatment on the back of your eyes to reduce the growth of these blood vessels. So that was a very trying time in my life. And I think with age, I got cataracts as well. But, the cataract operations were straightforward, and I do feel my eyes are very good at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I also had feet problems. You know, the longer you have diabetes, your peripheral circulation at the bottom of your feet is going to deteriorate. So you have to get that monitored and completely. And the worst thing you could do ever is walk barefoot anywhere. You have to always be aware of being careful of step on something, you might not feel it. And if it goes in, and then you're going to have infections, and you could wind up with ulcers and just infections with diabetes. It can be slow to heal, and they do heal, and everything, you know, is just can be as possible as a normal person, but it just takes longer. ¶¶
So having spoken about some of the side complications that people with diabetes can incur, I thought it might be interesting to talk to a doctor who specialises in one of these fields. So I travelled back to Glasgow to Gartnavel General Hospital, where I spoke to consultant ophthalmologist Dr. John Murdoch, who specialises in diabetic eye disease. I started off by asking him how he'd become a specialist in this field.
Well, I trained in Manchester as a, well, first of all, as an ophthalmologist, as you say, and then as a retinal surgical specialist. And one of the larger parts of retinal surgery is advanced diabetic eye disease. And when I took up my consultant post here in Glasgow, I inherited the diabetic eye clinic from one of my predecessors. And that's really where the interest in diabetic eye disease developed. Over the years, I've been doing this work here in Glasgow now for about 16 years, and so developed a lot of expertise in the management of diabetic eye disease and have seen some changes in the way the disease has developed.
And I know, Dr. Murdoch, there are two different strains of diabetes, type 1 and type 2, and I've been talking largely about type 1 in this programme, but I wondered whether it was type 1 or type 2 that particularly go on to develop complications such as diabetic eye disease, or do you find people with both types coming into your clinic?
Diabetic eye disease affects both people with type 1 and type 2 diabetes. There are really two types of diabetic eye disease. The diabetes affects the small blood vessels in the eye, and it can affect them really in two ways. It can block the blood vessels, resulting in an infarction, a bit like a heart attack at the back of the eye, or you can get the leaky blood vessels, which mean that the retina becomes swollen and doesn't see too well. The blockage of the blood vessels is more common in the type 1 diabetics, and the leaky blood vessels is more common in the type 2 diabetics. But both forms of the disease can be found in both types of diabetics.
And do you find, I know that things they say affect it, can be, well, it can be the length of time maybe you've had whichever type of diabetes, also blood pressure and like blood sugar controls as well. Do you find that control definitely helps people perhaps not to develop this, or if they kind of get through it to maybe keep it stabilised or inactive?
I think in your question there, you really hit the nail on the head with the factors that make the diabetic eye disease worse. Really, the number one factor is the duration of diabetes. The longer you have the disease, the more likely you are to have diabetic eye disease. However, it's not a foregone conclusion that if you have the disease for a certain length of time, you're going to get eye problems. The disease process is modifiable by your control of your diabetes and also your blood pressure. If you have good diabetic control and good control of blood pressure, you really, really reduce your chances of getting diabetic eye disease.
And do you find, your services or the amount of people come to see you, has this gotten bigger and bigger? I know like within your ward there's an actual area now for specifically for people with diabetic eye problems. Would you see, has this been rising, I suppose, in the same way that people getting diabetes has been on the rise?
The answer to that, it's not a simple answer. Yes, there are more people with diabetes, and because there's more people with diabetes, there are more people with diabetic eye disease. But the management of diabetes is getting so much better. So people with severe diabetic eye disease that we're seeing, that number I would say is declining. But overall, we're seeing patients. The other thing that's modifying this is the screening programs that we have. They're identifying diabetic eye disease at a much earlier stage. So we're getting more patients referred in very early. So yes, we're seeing more patients with diabetic eye disease, but we're not seeing as many patients with severe diabetic eye disease.
Would you say there would become a day when, you know, I don't know if they're looking into anything that they give people some kind of pill or something that will stop them getting these problems outright? Or is it really just a case, do you think, at the moment of, you know, look after your condition if you have it and kind of learn about, you know, the things you need to do?
There's two ways I would like to answer that question. The first is, yeah, the better you look after your diabetes, the less likely you are to have diabetic eye problems. But for people who already have diabetic eye disease in the type, in the form of maculopathy, that's the leaky blood vessels I have already alluded to during your earlier question, there has been a fairly new and exciting development in the management of that, in that for the last 5 years, people with age-related macular degeneration have been getting injections of Lucentis into the eye, and this has really been a miracle cure for a previously untreatable condition. Now, over the last few years, research has been done to see if this Lucentis injection works in diabetic maculopathy, and the results have come out that this works. Now, it's suggested that people with diabetic maculopathy would benefit from these injections, but the problem is they may require one of these injections once a month for the rest of their life if they get diabetic maculopathy.
Okay.
Now, if you were diagnosed with maculopathy in your 60s, that's potentially 10, 15 years of monthly injections, each costing in the region of £800. So this is a new development. The treatment has been proven effective, but it has not yet been approved by the authorities as a recognised NHS treatment. So this is going to be a new and exciting development over the coming months.
Now, Dr. Murdoch, I'm going to finish off by asking you a question here. And what I wondered was, although there are many people with diabetes and type 1 diabetes, not every one person with a condition is ever the same. And I wondered whether there was a particular group who were more prone to diabetic eye disease, in your opinion, or people perhaps that come in with a more severe version of the conditions.
I think there's one particular subgroup of diabetics that I'd like to highlight the importance of good diabetic control for, and that is young girls in their teens. There's a small subgroup of patients who become, they're diagnosed, you know, in their first decade of life with diabetes, and they're type 1 diabetes, and when they hit their teen years, they become a bit rebellious and don't look after their diabetes perhaps as well as they should. And then when they reach their mid-20s, they run into very serious eye problems that I often end up having to operate on, and sometimes they do not do so well. So the message would be for, you know, particularly young teenage girls, that's a really important time to look after your diabetes.
Yeah, and that's obviously a statistic that you just see coming in and out your doors then.
If I look at my patients who have the most aggressive diabetic eye disease, they virtually all come into that category.
So having spoken to some of the specialists and the doctors and the nurses and the organisations and people even with type 1 diabetes, I thought it might be interesting to finish off the programme by talking to the parent of a young child who developed it in the last few years. So I spoke to Nina Nealon, whose son Ethan developed the condition a couple of years ago, and I started off by asking her if this was something present in her family already.
No, it wasn't. Not in my immediate family. When Ethan was diagnosed, we heard of one of my cousins that had diabetes, and but we weren't sure whether it was type 1 or 2. And then I had always known that one of my aunts, but she was deceased and has been deceased for nearly as long as that I'm alive, had diabetes, but no one could tell me whether it was type 1 or 2. But when the district nurse came to visit us, she said for it to be relevant to your family, it has to be in someone in their 40s who is alive. So in that respect, we don't have anybody in our family that has it.
And did you know much about type 1 diabetes when you were told Ethan had it and what it entailed as a condition?
No, not really. I had a very faint idea. I know a lady that got type 1 diabetes through her pregnancies. And, you know, in fairness, like, she was very good. But, you know, when she was diagnosed, she had a very good attitude, and she just kind of said, oh, I just have to take injections with my food, you know, and just watch what I eat and that kind of thing. And because it's just somebody I knew, that was it. You know, I didn't get into any more detail.
And how has it affected you? I know it's been a number of years now, but how has it affected the family, I guess, from there to now?
Well, knowledge is power, and I have a lot more knowledge now, and I feel a lot better now. But in the beginning, I was absolutely shocked that he got it. I was frightened. I was wishing that I could have the diabetes, not him. Scared to leave the hospital. You know, when you were in the hospital and the nurses were there and they were doing his bloods and or that you felt safe in that environment. I felt very vulnerable coming home with him, you know, that how would I manage it at home? How would we manage? All those kind of feelings. I was really scared in the beginning.
And would you say that Ethan's condition has affected the whole family, as well as obviously some lifestyle changes for Ethan himself?
Oh, you know, it definitely affected the whole family. Definitely. When he was first diagnosed, we were on what was called Mixitard, which meant he was just on two injections a day, but he had to get snacks at certain times. So, I mean, you know, you had to be very organised. The spontaneity, like, is gone. And I felt, you know, that I was forgetting about other people in the family, you know, that I would concentrate mainly on him, which wasn't right. But, you know, it's the first thing you think of in the morning, and it's you think of it all day long, because it's something that has to be checked 3 or 4 times a day. So it is in your mind all the time. Everybody, you know, the school has been excellent. My workplace has been excellent. You know, if they do need to call me, there is never an issue from the school for them to call me at work, you know, if they need me. You know, on a personal level, I can find it a very lonely place to be, because I am the carer of his diabetes, you know, because he was diagnosed when he was 8. So he was too young to take that responsibility on for himself. So obviously the responsibility was mine. And I would find trying to work it out, if I got it wrong, I would beat myself up. You know, if I gave him too much insulin or too little insulin, you know, that his next reading, that he was high or low, I'm like, you know, you got it wrong again. And my husband would say to me, you know, Nina, you didn't get it wrong. It's a learning curve. We're all learning. And every day is different.
And I suppose he's maybe getting to an age now where at some stage you might have to take things over himself. How are you feeling about that?
Well, that's another issue, you know.
Yeah.
In one way, I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to, you know, giving him the independence from me. And, you know, and it will make his life a little bit easier. But I'm also dreading it, you know, that he will forget, that he won't do it right, or be like, oh, I'll just do this today. I'll just take this and not give the insulin for it, you know, that sort of way, or not record his bloods, or, you know, just rebel. You know, I definitely agree that there needs to be more information about type 1 diabetes out there for the public and for people who are diagnosed. I did a course recently on carbohydrate counting, and that has given me so much more power. I am managing Ethan's diabetes much better now, you know, and I know how to manage it when he's high, how much insulin I need to give him to bring him down, or if he's low, how much insulin to take off his next injection so he won't go low again. You know, and he can eat a lot more foods now that he couldn't eat before, because I can carbohydrate count them and I can match the insulin to the food, and it has given us a whole new lease of life. And we are on the road to getting the pump. That's our next port of call. I have been accepted in Crumlin to be on the list to get a pump for Ethan, which hopefully will give us the next step to a more normal life.
And that concludes our documentary, Diabetes, the Forgotten Type 1s. I'm a radio producer, I'm a music journalist, and I'm a singer. I'm also a person with type 1 diabetes and have been living with this for 22 years. My name is Heather McLeod, and I produced and presented this programme. My thanks to all the contributors who took part in the documentary, including Anne MacDonald, Anne Mullen, Shona Brearley, Professor Seamus Screenan, Dr. John Murdoch, Greg French, Nina Nealon, and Margaret Corbett. A special thanks to the staff at Connolly and Gartnavel General Hospitals. This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland. You can contact me for any further information about anything contained in this programme at heather@dublincityfm.ie.